Why is it even controversial that animals have feelings and thoughts?
There are numerous examples of different animals that understand who's competing with them and whose interests are not the same as theirs, that it's worth lying about it. So how hundreds of papers could be published insisting that only humans have this theory of mind capacity is to me completely mind-boggling. It makes no sense at all. And I think it's because we don't give any animals any credit, and it's so easy not to give them any credit because it reinforces our favorite story, which is we are completely unique and we are the best there is.
That's biologist Carl Safina. We spend the hour with him talking about his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. This is Writer's Voice, heard on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. On the cover of Carl Safina's new book, Beyond Words, is the photo of a baby elephant being gently lifted to its feet by a circle of solicitous elders. The image captures better than any words the caring and cooperation that characterize these magnificent and perilously endangered animals. When you think about it, the notion that only we humans evolved to have emotions and thoughts is bizarre. The other animals have arms, mouths, and noses, much as we do, so why wouldn't they have feelings and thoughts as well? Yet that common-sense view is scorned by much of the scientific establishment. The prevailing view is that animals are some kind of instinctual automatons, maybe because that way it's easier for us to justify our cruelty toward them. In his book Beyond Words, Carl Safina challenges this scientific convention by showing us the richness of the mental and emotional lives of the other animals, how they care and cooperate, how they strategize for advantage, how they communicate and create tools for their use. In his quest to understand who animals are, Safina followed elephant families in the African bush, wolf packs in Yellowstone, and killer whales in Alaska, among them the elephant matriarch Teresia and the wolf leader 21. And he doesn't leave out the less charismatic animals either. At a time when so many of them are disappearing because of us, Carl Safina's new book is a passionate plea for our understanding of those we share this earth with before it's too late. Carl Safina's work has been recognized with MacArthur, Pew, and Guggenheim Fellowships, and his writing has won Orion and National Academies Literary Awards, among others. He co-chairs the steering committee of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science and is founding president of the Safina Center. I spoke with him at his home on Lazy Point in Amagansett, New York. Carl Safina, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
This book, Beyond Words, I mean, I have to say I've enjoyed all your books.
Thank you.
But this one, I think, is my favorite. And I'm not sure it's because of the topic, or because it is such a passionate plea for our understanding of those we share this earth with. And I think it's a very important book. Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And I'd like to start out, I'm going to ask you to read two passages, but okay. First, the very first paragraph in the book, it's in the prologue. It's Into the Mind Field is the name of the chapter.
Another big group of dolphins had just surfaced alongside our moving vessel, leaping and splashing and calling mysteriously back and forth in their squealy, whistly way, with many babies swift alongside their mothers. And this time, confined to just the surface of such deep and lovely lives, I was becoming unsatisfied. I wanted to know what they were experiencing and why to us they feel so compelling and so close. This time I allowed myself to ask them the question that is forbidden fruit. Who are you? Science usually steers firmly from questions about the inner lives of animals. Surely they have inner lives of some sort, but like a child who is admonished that what they really want to ask is impolite, a young scientist is taught that the animal mind, if there is such, is unknowable. Permissible questions are it questions about where it lives, what it eats, what it does when danger threatens, how it breeds. But always forbidden is the one question that might open the door. Who?
Right. That is a question at the center of this book. I wonder if you can unpack that question for us. What are you thinking of when you're asking the question, who?
We, as human beings, are defined by our relationships to others. And we are not unique in that. There are other kinds of animals that are completely defined by their relationships to others, such as elephants and certain kinds of whales and wolves. And they know who they are, and they know who their friends are. They know who their rivals are. They aspire to higher status. They wait for their chance to challenge the existing order. And those animals are who animals, and we are among them. And then, because everything about life occurs on a sliding scale, on a continuum, there are some that are largely defined by their relationships to others. There are some that are a little bit defined, like, for instance, birds in the breeding season. They know who they are. They know where their nest is. They know who their mate is. Many of them recognize their specific chicks. But after the breeding season, not so much. And then there are others that are individuals, but they're not defined by their relationships to other individuals, like herring in a school of herring. They don't have a social structure. They just have a big group. Even wildebeest don't have a social structure, or something like a mosquito has, you know, no society. But everything is on a continuum. So you have everything all the way from something like a mosquito, which has no social life, except to find a mate at some point, all the way up to an elephant or a killer whale who will stay with their mother for their entire life, which may span 50 or 60 years, or sometimes, in the case of killer whales, more than that.
And it's not just these higher order animals. I mean, you even give some examples of insects that seem to have an understanding of their relationship to others.
Right. So I wanted to cast a wide net and keep an open mind, because an open mind is the most scientific thing you can really have. And I was interested really in how other animals experience living. How vivid are their lives? And it turns out that, you know, for many of them, life is very vivid, and they have superhuman senses. Many of them have much better eyesight, or much better hearing, or much better smell. Many of them are long-distance migrants whose sense of the world that they inhabit is not just a small neighborhood or even a big neighborhood, but it's, you know, it's really truly vast, and yet they can find their way there and back. And so I wanted, you know, to ask the question of how are their brains like our brains, and what do they do that either shows or suggests that they know what's going on, that they learn things. So in the case of, you know, many mammals and many birds, there's really a lot going on with them. But it's interesting to speculate about even invertebrates, like many kinds of insects or crayfish or things like that, because their nervous system, the nerves all look the same under a microscope. So it's a matter of how those nerves are connected and what they do. But they also produce the same chemicals that in humans give us our moods and our motivations. And that is evidence, along with their behavior, that all makes sense. You know, something that you threaten reacts as though it's scared or defensive. So that makes sense, right? So this is all evidence that they are experiencing something. The closer to humans you get, like mammals, the more like our experiences they appear to be having. So that the explorations in the book are really all about this question. You know, what is life like for us all, including all the non-humans that share the world with us? And how do they value their lives?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Safina about his new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel.
You actually turn the notion around. Not only are you looking at how animals are like us, but there's even a more profound question, which is, how are we like them? In other words, the kinship that we have with them derives in some way from how much we are like animals, like other animals.
Sure. There are actually two big questions here, I would say. One is this question you just posed. How are they like us and how are we like them? It's sort of the same question. And humans are animals. So our thoughts and our emotions are the thoughts and emotions of animals. And the other question, which I actually think is more interesting, is who are they, like us or not? Because if we ask, how are they like us, that's a question about us. And if we ask, does my dog really love me or does she just want a treat, that's a question about us. We are the animal kingdom's greatest narcissists, certainly. And we are essentially, you know, almost all the time only interested in ourselves. Even when we ask about other animals, we ask about what, you know, it's like, what do they think of us? It's like that old joke where somebody who is really unbearable saying, but I've talked enough about myself. What do you think about me? And that's how we are with animals, you know? And so the question that I ask at the beginning of the book that also runs through the whole book is who are they? And what is life like for them? Along a gigantic spectrum, not just the ones that the book focuses on, but all the others that are included by reference in the book.
Now, this is a question that, as you say, has not only gone unexplored, but there's been active persecution of scientists who try to explore this question. How did the notion that animals did not have consciousness even come about?
I think the notion that they do not have consciousness is fairly associated with Descartes, who said that they don't. And the other issue is whether science could ask the question, what is happening in the inner lives of other animals? And the reason that scientists could not ask that question, I think, is different. And I think it's because the first scientist who started to try to make a science of animal behavior, which was recent, only in about the 1940s and 50s, they had to establish that this is a serious science. So they had to get rid of all the caricatures about animals that, you know, that grasshoppers are lazy and that foxes are clever. And so basically they said, okay, look, we're starting with a blank slate here, and we're just going to describe what they do. That will be the science of animal behavior. We can't know what's going on in their mind. We have no way of asking that question. And so we won't do that. And those people were geniuses, and they started a new science. But the geniuses were followed by their students, and those people just said, well, we're not allowed to ask those questions, and neither are you. And this became a straitjacket that became totally unreasonable, because at first they were saying, look, we have to have an open mind here. Grasshoppers are not lazy. Foxes are not clever. We'll just watch them and see what they do. And then that open-mindedness turned into a total closed door on exactly the same kind of question. Well, what do they really do? And what do they experience? You just were not allowed to ask that. But when they started, no one had systematically watched animals in the wild do their thing. And no one had even watched animals in laboratory experiments. They were new. It was new. The point is, there was nothing to go on. And we knew very little about the brain and the nervous system in the 1940s compared to now. And now there's just really a lot more to go on. And you can make a lot of very reasonable speculations about what's going on, but you can also see what they're doing. And you can draw on thousands of studies of the behavior of animals in the wild and behavior of animals in laboratory experiments and what they do. You can look at an incredible amount of new stuff that we know about brains and nervous systems and hormonal systems and how they create emotional responses and mood responses or mood disorders and things like that.
One of the things you talk about in this book, Carl Safina, in Beyond Words, is the whole notion of theory of mind. You reserve some of your most acid pen, I'd say, in critiquing this notion of theory of mind. I'd like to ask you first to explain what it is, but then also talk about the whole mirror experiment. I think probably a lot of our listeners are familiar
sure.
with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the notion that animals, most animals don't recognize themselves in the mirror is still pretty common.
Yeah, and that's true. Most animals don't recognize themselves in the mirror, but we'll get to that. So you asked me first about theory of mind. One of the problems with all these concepts, these labels like theory of mind, self-awareness, even intelligence, sentience, consciousness, all of these very important words, is that they don't have an accepted definition in the field of behavior. People argue about these things using very different definitions. So just for instance, some people say that consciousness is the ability to think forward and backward in time and ponder one's own death. And other people say consciousness is having sensations and a mental experience. For instance, when you get total anesthesia, you are made unconscious. That's the opposite of conscious. It has nothing to do with what kinds of things you're experiencing or thinking. It's just the fact that you are. So the first thing is you have to define what you're talking about with these terms in order to talk about what you're talking about. So this terribly awkward sounding term, theory of mind, is defined very differently by some different people. The most useful definition is it's the ability to understand that another individual can have different thoughts and a different agenda, have different interests than you do. That's not a problem, because that's a useful thing to talk about. The problem is that many people have insisted that only human beings are able to know that another has thoughts and another has potentially the same or a different or competing agenda. And there are hundreds of studies insisting that theory of mind is a human attribute and no other animals have it. But that's patently absurd. And the thing that really strikes me is how incredibly dense many people are, or ignorant many people are who write about this, about what other animals do. When an animal sees a predator, for instance, it knows that the predator's agenda may not be the same as its agenda, and it responds very appropriately. When a dog runs around to the front of you with a ball in its mouth, it knows that when you're not facing the dog, it needs to get your attention, and you're capable of throwing the ball, and it can anticipate the pleasure of that. There are other animals that lie, and this is very well documented, that people have seen on numerous occasions things like a monkey will give an alarm call that scatters everybody, but there is no danger. It's just that that was a low-ranking monkey who wasn't getting any fruit in the tree and wanted to clear everybody out so it could quickly grab a couple of handfuls of fruit before it was again chased away by the higher-ranking ones. Somebody watched a group of hyenas where they were walking along and the lowest-ranking youngest hyena happened to turn its head and glance directly at a leopard that was crouched over a kill it had just made. None of the other hyenas noticed it. So what did the low-ranking hyena do? Absolutely nothing, until they all walked over a hill, and then it came running back to grab that kill because it knew that if it had gone on a beeline, it wouldn't get any of it. Chimpanzees do stuff like that a lot. There are numerous examples of different animals that understand enough about who's competing with them and whose interests are not the same as theirs that it's worth lying about it. Not to mention things like play and invitation to play and other kinds of engagement or running away from a dangerous individual or a potential predator. So how hundreds of papers could be published insisting that only humans have this theory of mind capacity is to me completely mind-boggling. It makes no sense at all. And I think it's because, like many of these things, we don't give any animals any credit, and it's so easy not to give them any credit because it reinforces our favorite story, which is we are completely unique and we are the best there is, and there's nothing in our category. And that's totally false on every level. I mean, biologically, we're part of a process. So you just see that everywhere you actually look, if you look.
As I was reading your book, Beyond Words, Carl Safina, and I was reading the section on theory of mind, you know, I had never questioned this notion of the mirror experiment. But of course, as I was reading it, then I thought, well, obviously, the only thing that's happening is that they don't understand what mirrors are.
They don't understand reflection. So the mirror test, as they call it, is supposed to show that an animal has self-awareness. And there are a couple of ways that you can do it. You can just give an animal a mirror and see what it eventually does after it gets used to the idea that the mirror is there. Or what is supposed to be the complete acid test is you put a mark on an animal, a little dot of makeup on its face, for instance, and then you touch the animal without putting the makeup on just so you can compare what they do. And if they go to the mirror and they look in the mirror and then they touch the dot on their actual face, that proves that they understand that the reflection in the mirror is them. But that's not what it really proves. What it really proves is that they understand that the reflection represents them. And as far as self-awareness, when animals, let's say, attack the mirror image, or when they invite the mirror image to play with them, what that shows is that they are self-aware. They just don't understand reflection. They think that the thing that is reflected is another individual. So that proves that they are self-aware. So what the test purports to prove is not what it proves. It's only a test about whether animals, A, understand reflection, and B, a much higher order thing that the testers haven't even ever thought of, as far as I can tell, and I've read a lot of these studies. The higher order thing is that they understand that the thing in the mirror represents them, and representation is something that is not at all common. So there are animals that mistake what's in the mirror, but a lot of animals, if not all, have self-awareness. They understand that they are different from their rivals and their competitors, or their babies, or their family members, or their friends. They understand where they are in the territory. And you can see that by lots of different things. For instance, let's just say a wolf kills an elk and it is eating the elk's leg. It never makes a mistake and starts eating its own leg. When puppies are playing and wrestling like crazy and they're biting each other like crazy, they're not half the time accidentally biting themselves. They absolutely know the difference between them and the other, and they absolutely are self-aware. And if they didn't know that difference, it's very hard for me to understand how anything could survive if it didn't understand the difference between itself, other individuals, and the rest of the world.
Right. Although I do remember my cat when she was a kitten used to bite her own tail. But she's learned not to do that. There is an even darker motive, though, that you hint at in this book, in Beyond Words, for humans to deny the self-awareness of animals, and that is that it would make us have to question the cruelty with which we treat them.
Well, it would make us question how we treat them, good and bad. And it would certainly make ignoring how they feel harder if we understood that they feel and that they can be joyful if they're treated really well and if they have a nice life. They can be relaxed and they can feel good, or they can have a miserable life. And if, you know, if that's kind of high on your mind, it affects your decision about what you're going to do in your treatment of animals. But we nowadays, I think, only sense that this is a question with regard to people and other animals. But in most of history, we treated other kinds of people in exactly the same way so that we didn't have to care about how terrible we were to them.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Safina about his latest book. It's Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. In this book, you went to watch elephants, you went to watch killer whales, and also the wolves in Yellowstone. What are the characteristics that these three species, these three very charismatic species, share that made them so apt as focal points for this book?
I wanted to choose some animals that had a complex social structure so that you could really see that they had lives that had an arc to them. You know, their lives sort of follow a career, and they obviously, you know, they're born young and generally with low status. Although there are some animals who inherit status from their parents, if they're born to high-ranking individuals. You see this with some monkeys, for instance, that the children of the high-ranking monkeys have high rank. And the same is true with hyenas and a few others. But, you know, in general, you start out low and you either age into or struggle your way into higher status. And then eventually you senesce. And there are people who have watched those animals that I chose for as long, in two cases, two out of the three, for as long as 40 years. And in the third case, a person who had watched the wolves in Yellowstone every single day for 15 years, 7 days a week for 15 years. So these were guides who could really explain who we were watching. And it was never, oh, there's a group of elephants over there. It was always, oh, there's Debbie and Dorothy and Desdemona. And, you know, Debbie survived the last drought, and Dorothy is her daughter who is 30 years old. And these kinds of stories, and the same thing with the killer whales and the same thing with the wolves, and who their parents had been and what had happened in the past that brought them here. And other animals are individuals, and they have individual personalities. They make decisions that are consistent with their personalities. Some are very bold. Some are very shy. Some are skittish. Some are very social. Some are kind of flaky. In the case of elephants, some of them inspire leadership, and others who should be leaders because of their age and their status in their family don't, and their family members ignore them where they should be following them. But there's something flaky about them. They don't make good decisions. They don't do things at the time or the place or the direction that everybody else thinks we should be going. And so they don't, you know, grant them the authority.
These are wonderful stories that you tell. And, you know, let's just start with some of the elephants. You've talked about the decision makers. Those are the matriarchs. I mean, elephants are right, led by the females. Tell us about some of the elephants that you most noticed on this trip.
Well, you know, it's noteworthy that in each of the three cases, females tend to lead the groups. Even in the case of wolves, which have more of a nuclear family, more like humans than almost anything else, the female makes more of the decisions, the so-called alpha female, which is just the breeding female. A wolf pack is just a family. It's just two breeders and their children of two or three generations. And as the children age, they go out on their own, just as in our families. But with elephants, there were many families, and there were some noteworthy things about some of the families. For instance, one of the families were the the daughters and descendants of a very famous elephant called Echo, who was the subject of a book by Cynthia Moss, Echo of the Elephants, and a television series on PBS in the 90s. Echo died, but what was noteworthy was that in the aftermath of her death, her family was slowly kind of splintering, and the daughter who took over leadership. Echo was famously a homebody. She never went very far. She stayed pretty close to the protected area. Her daughter, who was a very capable leader and took over leadership, is much more of a roamer, and she takes them much farther, which nowadays is very worrisome because there is so much killing right now. The killing of elephants is so completely out of control in the area where they live, on the border of Kenya and Tanzania. One of the ones in that family who should have ascended to leadership by reason of her age is known as an elephant that none of the family members want to follow. So she often kind of goes off by herself, with maybe one or two others will go with her, but she's not an inspiring leader. So another one that's a little younger is basically the one that has inherited the mantle of leadership in that family, which is an unusual way for that to happen. And then there are some families that are kind of artificial. They're composed of family fragments of elephants whose families had experienced a lot of killing from poachers. And the families were shattered, and yet they came together and act as a family unit now. There was one elephant with unbelievable tusks, and his name is Tim. And he vanishes for weeks at a time. His tusks are so gigantic, he looks kind of like a mammoth. I mean, they just about touch the ground. And the idea that he is still alive is astonishing. And, you know, one wonders what his survival strategy is. We saw that some of the elephants that are tagged hide during the day when they're outside of these protected areas. And the protected areas are almost all too small for them to live in for their whole lives. There are sources of food and water that have always been traditional in their travels that are now kind of cut off. There are villages in between. And there are times when they want to go there because the food is really good or the water is really good. And you can sometimes see that during the day they're hiding. Mm. They're in very dense brush and they're not moving. And then at night they move very, very rapidly. They sort of streak through these danger zones. They know what's going on.
Wow. And he's at danger because of the ivory trade.
Yes, exactly.
Carl Safina, talking about his latest book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Stay tuned for more stories about elephants and also stories about wolves and dolphins, including about dolphins training humans to help them fish. That's after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with the great conservation biologist and author Carl Safina, talking about the thoughts and feelings of animals. Before the break, we heard about some of the elephant matriarchs of the African bush. I also asked Safina about the poignant story by Lyle Watson he cites in his new book. It's about an elephant Watson saw in a remarkable encounter with a whale on South Africa's seacoast.
In that passage, the writer witnessed that he heard these sounds in the air, these sort of deep, rumbly sounds. And then he realized that just outside the surf was a blue whale. The blue whale is the largest animal that has ever lived on Earth, and it is also one of the most depleted, demolished of all of the great whales. It suffered just about the most during the real heyday of whaling in the 20th century. In some places it was sort of completely wiped out, and in many other places within a tiny hair's breadth of extinction. So there are very few of them, is the point. And this blue whale was alone. And then he heard this rumble again in the air. And suddenly he saw this elephant who he knew unmistakably was the last elephant in this province in South Africa. And she was this old matriarch who should be surrounded by her children and her grandchildren. And she was alone. And there were no other elephants left. And she and the whale were, she was at the edge of the surf and the whale was facing her. And they seemed to be, in their loneliness, they seemed to be trading calls. Whales make very low frequency calls that can travel hundreds of miles through the water, and they can hear other whales and know where they are hundreds of miles away. And elephants, somewhat similarly, make very low frequency calls that travel through the sound, and elephants miles away, not hundreds of miles, but miles away, can hear and respond to them. So that's what he thought was going on, and he described the scene and he described what he thought was going on. And just the idea of these two gigantic, lonely matriarchs was really terribly sad. You know, it was just terribly sad to think that it has come to that anywhere, that anyone can watch essentially the last two left in a large area, because that is the geometry of extinction. You know, it's not like there's going to be one big bunch and then there's going to be the last one. They're going to be blinking out in different places. And that is what actually is happening, especially with elephants.
Well, that's a terribly poignant story. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about the idea about animal communication. You know, I think that one of the notions that human beings have had is that we are the only creatures that talk, you know, as if, you know, right. The kinds of words that we right. use, we expect other animals to be using those
right,
words.
Right.
And you really explode that notion, not only that animals have their own vocabulary, different animals have their own vocabulary that they share, but also their own syntax.
Yeah, there are some. Now, I should preface this by saying I do think that human vocal language is more complicated in terms of having a larger specific vocabulary and more complicated rules of grammar and syntax than appears to be the case in any other species. But there's an awful lot that other animals get across with either a small vocabulary and a few rules of syntax, or a number of different calls that basically mean certain kinds of things, and their meaning can be interpreted by the circumstances under which that call is uttered, or by the intensity or volume of that call. And so what certainly is the case, that far, far, far from humans being the talkers and the other animals just being dumb animals making noises, other animals have a lot of rich communication that allows them to function very, very effectively in a very complicated life, a life where, you know, they have to get their entire living out of the world around them. They have to know where things are. They have to know what to do. They have to have skills. Some of them have to coordinate with others in their families for hunting or foraging, or to know where to go to survive a terrible drought, for instance. And so there's rich, rich information that is both coming in that they are understanding appropriately, or that they are communicating. And some animals have words for certain things. Elephants have words for bees and a few other things. And some monkeys have a small vocabulary. Chimpanzees have dozens of gestures that have specific meanings. And gorillas have even more gestures that have specific meanings. And the other ape called bonobos, their gestures are very human-like in some cases. If they want another one to come over, they will simply wave the other one over. And if they want to go and have a tryst behind a bush, once they wave the other one over, they will indicate with a sweep of their palm where they want to go to have some hanky-panky. So there's a lot that is going on in their minds and in their communication. Some animals have words that are understood by other animals that are not even their species. For instance, we were in Trinidad not too terribly long ago, about a year ago, and we were birding, and our birding guide said, "Oh, there's a mot-mot calling snake." Now, he knew this bird's call for snake, and we walked about a quarter of a mile or so, and not only, sure enough, was there a mot-mot in a tree scolding at a snake and blowing the snake's cover, but a bunch of other birds of different species knew exactly what that meant, and they had all come in also to say, "The snake is over there, you know, don't be fooled, don't be tricked, and let's get the snake out of there," and they were pecking the snake, and they were really, you know, harassing it. So they were all in on the conversation, including our guide, who knew the mot-mot word specifically for snake.
You talk in the book, Carl Safina, you talk in Beyond Words of the example of killer whales in Australia training humans to be their hunting partners, so that this kind of communication, cross-species communication, isn't just one where they're understanding us, but they're also teaching us.
Yes, that's the extraordinary thing. There are three cases that I know of where dolphins, including killer whales, which are by far the largest dolphin, trained fishermen to know that they have herded the prey within range, and now they want the fishermen to do their part so they can share the catch. In the case of these killer whales in Australia, for the better part of a century, they would chase big whales into this particular bay, and then they would come to the whaling station, or some of them would come to the whaling station to alert the whalers by jumping and slapping around in the water and say, "We have a whale in the bay, come." And the whalers would go out, they would attack the whale. The killer whales would then help, sometimes to the point where the killer whales would be grabbing the harpoon line to slow the whale down to hasten its killing. And then they would, you know, get the meal, and the whalers would then get the rest of the whale. There are a couple of other places where dolphins herd fish near the shoreline and then signal to fishermen, the fish are here, throw your nets now. And then inevitably there are injured fish that fall out of the nets and get to be easy prey for the dolphins.
That's phenomenal. You also talk about empathy. I mean, I think we're talking here about the different characteristics that people have, you know, said that only humans have. We haven't gotten to tool using yet, but we've talked about communication and theory of mind. Empathy. There's a wonderful story in the book about a herder whose leg was accidentally broken by an elephant matriarch. Tell us that story.
Yes, there was an altercation and she broke his leg and seemed to, whether she had second thoughts or regretted it, who knows. But she acted as though this was a problem that she recognized, because she guarded him all night.
She actually took him into the shade of a tree.
Yes, she moved him to a better place, mm-hmm. and then she guarded him. You know, she didn't go off with her family. She wasn't eating. She was hanging around this hurt guy in a place that she moved him to until other people showed up who came looking for him. Mm-hmm. And he was rescued that way.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carl Safina about his latest book. It's Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Now, wolves, let's talk about the wolves. Tell us first about the role of the wolves in the Yellowstone ecosystem, because they weren't not always there. They were there in ancient times.
They were only there for, a million years or something
like that.
But then...
They were extirpated.
They were wiped out. Essentially, every wolf south of the Canadian border was killed. And the Park Service killed the last wolves in Yellowstone Park in the 1920s, quite on purpose. And then the deer and the antelope play, you know, as the song goes. They exploded in number over those decades of having no predation. And we see actually a similar problem in our suburbs. There are deer everywhere because they lack their predator, which is the wolf. And the elk and the deer in Yellowstone got to such numbers that they started exporting elk to many places where the elk themselves had been shot out completely, trying to reintroduce them there. And then when there really wasn't a need or more places for them to be shipping these extra elk, the elk just got to such numbers that they ate more or less everything that they could eat. So wolves were, after an incredible political fight, wolves were reintroduced in Yellowstone in the late 1990s. They did extremely well at first, and their numbers went way, way, way up, and they started to affect the numbers of elk and bring things back in balance. And now that things are rebalancing, the wolf numbers are actually starting to decline in Yellowstone from the highs that they were in the early O's.
Why is that?
Because they came into a place with unnaturally superabundant food. And now, they've rebalanced. They've eaten a lot of the excess of these elk numbers. And, their food resources are... Just the amount of food that's there is less than it was after six decades of being there with no wolves.
And it's made a big difference in the health of the ecosystem.
Yes, it does seem to have made a big difference, not only for the vegetation, but for a lot of things that, birds that nest in shrubs, for instance, and even for beavers that need willows and aspen along the riverbanks, and beaver dams mean more habitat for fish and frogs and things like that. So it's a whole suite of things, yes.
So tell us about some of these amazing wolves that you learned about in Yellowstone. There were two of them. There was the wolf 21 and his granddaughter 06.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, 21 was, by all accounts, a super wolf. That's what he was often called. He was one of the very first wolves born after the reintroduction in the park. His father, by the way, one of the reintroduced wolves, had been shot. The history of the reintroduction is full of people shooting the wolves. As soon as they go anywhere near the park border, they go over that imaginary line. There are people with guns willing to shoot wolves. But anyway, so this precocious pup with research collar number 21 grew up to be an exceptionally capable individual and became the breeding male of what grew to be the largest wolf pack ever recorded. Their numbers were in the mid-20s, about two dozen wolves in this one pack.
And you use his story to talk about leadership.
Yes, I use his story to talk about leadership for a couple of reasons. One was that he never lost a fight, and yet he never killed a wolf that he beat. Each of those things are extraordinary, and the combination is unheard of. And he died of old age at a place of his choosing, a favorite rendezvous site, where he would often meet with his mate and pups. And he went there and he laid down and he passed away. But the other thing about alpha wolf leadership is that, in the business jargon that we hear a lot about, we hear about alpha males. And these are supposed to be the snarling boss, the overbearing supervisor, the people who are trying to whip their employees into shape, and basically are not very nice people, and they're called alpha males, as though they're acting like wolves, who are their the pack leaders. But real wolves are not like that at all, because, first of all, just think about it. What family would function better? The one where the father is constantly beating up on everybody and making everyone fearful, or the one where everybody gets along well, where the adult with the experience leads by example and takes care of the young ones and shows that he knows what to do and inspires leadership? That's what a real alpha wolf is like. And that's what the best kind of alpha boss is like as well.
And 06.
And 06 was another wolf who was his granddaughter and an exceptionally capable female who was probably the most able hunter of all the wolves in Yellowstone. And almost all the time that wolves hunt, they hunt in a group, and several are needed because they hunt prey that are much larger than themselves. A very, very, very big wolf weighs about 140 pounds. And many of their prey are elk that weigh 500, 700 pounds. So they hunt in groups, and that's what they're adapted to do, and that's what a wolf pack is all about. But 06, this incredible female, on several occasions killed an elk all by herself, and she was at the helm of a very successful pack that involved her and two brothers. That was a really unusual thing about it. There were two adult males with her, her actual mate that she bred with, and his brother, who was sort of like a non-breeding uncle in the pack. In the fall of 2012, Wyoming took wolves off the endangered species list in the state, and the federal government took wolves off the endangered species list, even though their quote recovery in the Rocky Mountains is a tiny, tiny fraction of how many there originally were there. But nonetheless, strictly because of political pressure, they came off the list. So the wolves in the park went from being totally protected to completely unprotected across an imaginary border. The wolves outside the park were getting so shot up that the wolves inside the park, when they got near the border, there were no other howls. There was nobody contesting their move. And in the winter, the elk mostly leave Yellowstone and the deer mostly leave Yellowstone because Yellowstone is a park for its scenery. It's a high, bleak place in the winter. Most of those animals are migratory and they leave. So when the wolves tried to follow their prey and they found no resistance, they went. And as soon as they did, 06 and her family, the non-breeding brother was killed almost instantly. They retreated a little bit. A few days later, they came back. 06 was killed. And the whole family, which had been this completely coherent, cohesive family, started to fall apart. The father left looking for his mate or maybe a new mate. When he left, two males who were looking for their opportunity in life came upon the remains of his pack, which were mostly females that were 2 or 3 years old. They thought, wow, this is a great opportunity for us. Well, that meant the father couldn't come back into the pack now. Even the daughters didn't want the father back in, and those new males certainly didn't want him. So he went from being the mate of this famous wolf and the leader of this very coherent pack to a wolf with no family, no territory, no hunting companions. Meanwhile, two of his daughters seemed to be very jealous around these two new males of one of their sisters, the one that was the most precocious and the most like her mother. And they ejected her forcibly from the pack over a period of several days. And she kept trying to come back into her family, and they wouldn't let her. And they were very rough with her. And I saw that happening myself. It was very startling. So she was ejected and suddenly was out. The whole family was falling apart because these two wolves got shot. And you saw the individuals, you saw the strategies, you saw the family vendettas, you saw the father and this daughter lose everything they had. The daughter stayed in the park for a few months, then wandered outside. She had no pack, no hunting companions. She was shot at someone's chicken coop. And the father, who I was certain had only a few months at best to live by scrounging other packs' kills, which is dangerous to do, survived against all odds. And he is still alive this year for the first time since 2012. That's 3 years later. He has a mate and a territory and pups. And is still going. He's getting old, and he's very gray looking now. But he is still alive. So that's just a story that just shows, you know, that these are lives. They're not interchangeable widgets. Things happen, and there are consequences to them and for them.
Yeah, I felt in reading this book that this is the critical consciousness that we need if we are to actually save ourselves as humans, much less the ecology of the planet that all ourselves and our relations have grown up with.
I wish I entirely agreed with you, but I think the main problem is precisely that we can survive without these beautiful and magnificent things, and it will be a sad and impoverished survival. But first of all, you know, there were other species of elephants on other continents. There were elephants in the Arctic after mammoths, I'm talking about. There were woolly mammoths in the Arctic after the Egyptians built the pyramids. They're gone, and we're still here. The whole Western Hemisphere has no native elephants, and people do quite well living in the Western Hemisphere. So I think that although it would be an unbelievably sad world, and if you think about the paintings you see of Noah's Ark, the animals that were worth saving, or how we paint animals on nursery room walls, we don't paint cell phones, we don't paint people working in their office cubicles, we paint animals because we want to welcome our children into a world that is richly filled with life. But the sad thing is we can exist all too well without them. Without some of them, but without most of the ones that are the great and magnificent beings. We don't need elephants in order to be alive, and we don't need whales, and we don't need many of the birds that we have. In fact, the passenger pigeon was the most abundant bird perhaps in the world. It's completely gone, and we're here. So we can exist, and we can certainly proliferate in a poorer and poorer world, and they cannot. And I'm much more concerned at this point about them, because the sad truth is we don't need them, but they at this point desperately need us to just let them live.
It's a beautiful book, and an important one, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to talk to you always.
And that is Carl Safina talking about his book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt. You can also hear Safina read a beautiful passage from the book about the elephants he observed in Africa. And you can also hear what's coming up next week here on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.